It is time to talk coffee. It is a staple in households across the country, and yet coffee production is in trouble in part because of our changing climate. A disease that used to pummel plants on the other side of the globe is now attacking crops in the Americas. Keely Baltina hosts this segment.
Some people might think that talking about coffee is superficial or tone deaf in this global pandemic. You actually acknowledge that. Why is this important to talk about coffee even in this moment?
It's not very well known that coffee crops worldwide, which are mostly coffee crops in the hemisphere of the Americas, are under threat by a disease that has been pursuing coffee around the world for about 150 years. The disease is called coffee leaf rust. It's a fungus, and it destroys harvests of coffee, not just for 1 year, but often for several years in a row. This is important, not just because so many of us depend on coffee for waking us up in the morning and managing our energy and anxiety during the day, but for several other reasons. The first is that coffee is a massive global enterprise that depends on the work, overwhelmingly, of very small farmers on small and often poor plots of land. Where they grow coffee, they have relatively few other options. So to take away their coffee plants, as this disease does, undermines an entire agricultural sector in poor parts of the world that have very few options for other things to do.
And it's a pretty big sector. I mean, 100 million people, you say, rely on this.
That's right. 100 million people around the world in some way draw their livelihood from coffee. Now, of course, that includes everything from the small farmers I've just been talking about to the giant multinational conglomerates that are the middlemen of coffee to the third wave coffee shop down the street and the barista who gives you your latte in the morning. That's a very long supply chain or value chain. But at the beginning of it are these farmers whose work is being undermined by this incredibly potent plant disease. And crucially, the reason this is happening is almost certainly because of the effect of climate change. While this disease, coffee leaf rust, has been recognized by science since the 1860s, it periodically has gotten worse with certain surges in weather. And those surges have now become dramatically worse at the same time that temperatures are rising in Central and South America and weather patterns are changing because of that warming.
This is a fungus. How much do those weather patterns you talk about matter? Does it spread more in dry years or wet years? Or what are the factors that play into this?
So it depends on temperature and on humidity. You know, if you think of the fungi that we are most familiar with, which is something like mushrooms, right? So, you know, we tend to think of mushrooms as something that grows in the garden when there's been a lot of rain. And that's equally true for the kind of fungus that coffee leaf rust is, which is a fungus that sporulates, lets go spores that drift on the wind and infect other plants and further the cycle. When it is more warm and when it is more wet, that cycle of sporulation accelerates, and also any one infection will not only produce spores more rapidly, but it will produce more spores. So warmer, wetter, less predictable weather is a favor to the disease and inimical to the livelihood of the farmers.
What does a healthy coffee plant look like? And then how do farmers realize that they're dealing with this disease?
So I spent a good bit of time last year before the pandemic began, actually in December 2019, with small-scale coffee growers in Guatemala. And maybe because it was December, which is the time when coffee is harvested from about November to about January in that part of the world, it kept occurring to me that healthy coffee plants look like Christmas trees. because their leaves are a glossy dark green and the coffee cherries, the pit of which is what we think of as a coffee bean, are brilliant red. They're gorgeous and they peek out between the leaves like ornaments. It's very easy to tell when a plant is infected because those glossy, healthy, dark green leaves turn dull and kind of matte on their surface because they're desiccating, they're being deprived of nutrition. But the indicator of a coffee leaf rust infection is a spot on the leaf that starts out as just a little yellow patch and then expands. And as it expands, the leaf tissue in the center dries out and turns dark brown. And if you turn the leaf over, on the underside of that scar are the spores. And the spores are dusty and they're orange. This is why the disease is called rust. It actually looks like rust on a piece of metal. And when you run your fingers across it, it comes off in a fine orange dust in the same way that rust would on a piece of metal. And those are the spores that can break free, drift on the wind, and travel to other plants nearby.
And what happens to the plants then and their ability to produce beans?
So, you know, but leaves are how plants draw nutrition from the world, right? We all learned about that in probably elementary school biology. So when the leaves are damaged, the plant's ability to process its nutrition is damaged as well. So then it won't set fruit or won't have flowers, won't set fruit, won't produce a crop. But also because it has been sort of systemically damaged in that way, it's not just that a single harvest, a single year is damaged, that a crop is not produced, but also that since the plant has lost leaves, it will be set up badly for the next growing season. So a coffee rust attack is often something that hampers production for several years in a row.
Maren McKenna writes about public health, global health, and food policy. We're talking about how coffee leaf rust has made its way to plants in the Americas and what that means for people who make a living off of coffee, who drink this stuff. I'm Keely Boltina, and this is the Ideas Network. Maren, you talked with farmers, and in the article you wrote, you kind of focus in on one particular person. Introduce us to him.
Sure. So Elmer Gabriel is a small farmer way up in the highlands of Guatemala, sort of in the kind of the southwest corner, if you think of Guatemala as having corners. His plot, which is called Finca La Felicidad, the farm of happiness, is outside a coffee growing town, again, a very small town called San Pedro Yepocapa. And Elmer is descended from a coffee farmer. His father was a coffee farmer, and Elmer has always wanted to be one. And he has a son, Brian, who also has always wanted to be a coffee farmer. But all of their lives, the lives of these three generations, they have been dealing with coffee rust, which first came to the Americas from across the Atlantic Ocean, blowing on the breeze or traveling on imported plants. No one is really sure. Initially in the 1970s and 80s, landed in the western part of South America and moved its way up into Central America. It's an interesting historical fact that the reason that that is the center of coffee growing now is because of this disease. It was first perceived in what were at the time coffee plantations in what's now Sri Lanka in the 1860s and 70s and completely wiped out coffee growing there, 90%, 100% crop loss, to the point that Sri Lanka became a tea growing center instead. And there are people who say, historians who say, that the reason that the United Kingdom is a tea drinking nation is because of that change of Sri Lanka, which was a colonial possession, from coffee growing to tea growing as a result of the disease. So this disease wafts across the Atlantic. It moves up into Central America. In the time of Elmer's father, it was possible to keep it under control with regular application of fungicides. And because the weather was relatively predictable, they knew when to use the fungicides. But fungicides cost money. And particularly for a small farmer in a small town, they're not going to use more agricultural chemicals than they absolutely need to. So the family kind of limped along in good years and bad years, controlling the rust as much as they could. And after a while, it seemed like it wasn't that much of a problem. And then Elmer bought his own farm, La Felicidad, and started growing coffee on his own. And the rust came back. And what he told me when I saw him, when I met him last year, is that it is no longer possible to control it with chemicals, that it is undermining the plants faster than they can apply, or with it would require more chemicals than they can afford. And they really have been looking at potential ruin and a potential inability of his son, Brian, to follow in his father's footsteps. In addition to this disease of coffee leaf rust, in addition to changes in weather and climate, coffee is actually not that expensive. Coffee prices are at historic lows around the world for reasons that are complex, because the pricing of coffee is a very complex algorithm. But the practical effect of that is that there's not very much money flowing back, particularly to the smaller farmers. And that means that their ability to invest more in their fields, or to buy better equipment, to buy more chemicals, possibly to buy another piece of land somewhere else, is really restricted.
And that's author Maren McKenna talking with WPR host Keely Boltina about a disease making its way to coffee plants across continents. Stay with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. WPR and Wisconsin Watch are documenting the lives of Wisconsinites in this unprecedented time with a series of audio diaries called Outbreak Wisconsin. Wisconsin hospitals are administering coronavirus vaccines to their staff, and that includes UW Health in Madison, where Mariah Clark is a nurse in the emergency department. She recorded this diary the day she learned she'd be getting the shot.
I just stepped outside after my post-work shower. It is December 17th, and it's nearly 6 a.m. I was about to go to bed, but this warrants noting. So I woke up yesterday morning on the 16th to a text message from one of my supervisors saying that I was scheduled to get my COVID-19 vaccination today. And I was just so excited. Honestly, I knew that we'd be among the first because, you know, emergency ICU and other staff with direct daily patient care of COVID-19 patients would be in the first tier for vaccination and part of the first bit of the rollout, but I didn't think I would be getting it quite so soon. So I was really excited to get that text message this morning. The science is amazing. The science is fascinating. And I mean, I am excited. I'm excited to help protect my patients and to help protect my family and to help protect myself. But most of all, I'm really happy that this is happening. And I'm happy to be part of history in one of the more significant mass vaccination campaigns of my lifetime. I'm excited to get the fastest developed vaccines in recent history. The last quickest vaccine development was the mumps vaccine, and that took 4 years and was considered remarkable. This took us 1 year. And while mRNA vaccination is new, mRNA vaccine research is not. And I am very comfortable getting this vaccine and hope to be able to be an example that encourages others to do the same when it becomes more and more widely available. And I hope that it means that slowly, gradually, months from now, return to something resembling the normalcy we knew before.
That was UW Health Emergency Department nurse Mariah Clark, who was vaccinated later that day on December 17th. You can find more on this series of audio diaries called Outbreak Wisconsin. It is at WPR.org/Outbreak Wisconsin. Coming up, it's a win for climate policy in the COVID relief legislation. Do you approve of Congress including measures to tackle climate change in the stimulus package? Or do you think it should have been limited to pandemic relief? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234 as we talk with a policy analyst from the Natural Resources Defense Council. You can join in at emailideas@WPR.org. We'll break it down after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Control of the Senate is at stake today in Georgia, where two runoff elections will determine whether Republicans keep their majority. GOP incumbents David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler are facing off against Democratic challengers John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock. The president and President-elect Joe Biden were each in Georgia yesterday to rally supporters. Emma Hurt with member station WABE reports on Trump's speech to supporters in Dalton.
The president set the tone at the top of his speech by saying there is, quote, no way he lost Georgia. He went on to repeat debunked conspiracy theories about voter fraud and vowed to return to Georgia to campaign against former ally Governor Brian Kemp. Kemp has refused to overstep the state constitution and intervene in the election. Despite the mixed messages, the president did still urge Republicans to vote in the runoffs.
The Democrats are trying to steal the White House. You cannot let them. You just can't let them steal the U.S. Senate. You can't let it happen.
More than 3 million early votes have been cast of about 7.7 million registered voters. For NPR News, I'm Emma Hurt in Dalton, Georgia.
Biden spoke to supporters of Ossoff and Warnock at a rally in Atlanta. National Guard troops have been activated in Washington, D.C. ahead of tomorrow's expected vote in Congress to affirm Joe Biden's win in the election. Protests are likely in the nation's capital. This is NPR News.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 7:31. I'm Melissa Ingalls. Canadian oil and gas company Cenovus Energy has closed on a nearly $5 billion deal to buy Calgary-based Husky Energy. As Danielle Kading reports, Husky owns and operates Wisconsin's only oil refinery.
The deal was first announced in October. The oil industry has struggled due to lower demand for fuel during the coronavirus pandemic. Husky reported billions in losses through the end of September. Cenovus CEO and president Alex Pourbaix said in a statement that the deal will make the company stronger and able to weather the current environment. The merger will lead to workforce reductions, but a Husky spokeswoman says the majority of job losses will take place in Canada. Husky typically employs around 200 workers year-round at the Superior Refinery. Hundreds more were expected to complete a $750 million rebuild to repair damage from an explosion 2 years ago. The president of the Northern Wisconsin Building and Trades Council, Kyle Bukovich, says he's been told the deal will have no effect on Husky's plans to rebuild. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Wisconsin Republicans have unveiled a new proposal to respond to the social and economic effects of the coronavirus pandemic. The wide-ranging bill was released Monday on the first day of the new legislative session. During the assembly's first meeting, Republican Speaker Robin Voss said the plan would be fast-tracked.
Those of you who were here know the legislature approved a bipartisan relief package within the first month of the pandemic. This week, the assembly should act once again.
Voss said the plan was written with the support of the GOP-controlled state Senate, but it faces an uncertain future with Democratic Governor Tony Evers. The bill includes several measures Evers has called, quote, poison pills, including limits on local health officials and schools that want to provide virtual instruction. Wisconsin's seven-day average for new coronavirus infections is starting to slowly rise after weeks of declines. The Department of Health Services confirmed 1,407 new cases yesterday, bringing the seven-day average to 2,255. That's up from the recent low of about 1,900 at the end of last year, but well below the peak of more than 6,500 in mid-November. Still, all of Wisconsin's 72 counties have been classified as having high levels of virus activity or higher, with most categorized as very high and three counties at critically high. It's WPR.
Support for WPR comes from businesses like Port Washington Tourism and Hansen & Associates. Business support plays an important role in WPR's success. Details on becoming a business sponsor are at wpr.org/sponsor.
Four simple steps can help stop COVID in Wisconsin. Wear a mask, wash your hands, limit gatherings, and maintain social distance whenever you go out. Together, we can save Wisconsin lives. Find out more at dhs.wisconsin.gov.